Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screen Bitch. Welcome to the podcast. We are so excited this week to talk about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, the latest entry into the Marvel Cinematic Universe and sequel to the original Guardians of the Galaxy. And for this, we brought in our comic guru, Arnaldo Reyes. Welcome, Arnaldo.
I'm Mary Poppins, y'all. Thank you.
You are Mary Poppins, y'all. he's a cool guy. And actually, happy anniversary to you. This past Friday was the release of our first episode ever 2 years ago. I believe it was May the 12th. And we talked about you and I. It was you and I on for Avengers Age of Ultron.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary. We started with a Marvel film, and I think it's a testament to Marvel that we are still talking about a Marvel film 2 years later.
Yeah, exactly. We started with Avengers, and, you know, here we are 2 years later, and probably a franchise that has taken over top spot in Marvel's cinematic library.
Yeah, it's true. Had the first Guardians come out by then? Yeah, of course it had. It came out before Ultron.
Yeah, it did.
It did, yeah. There's so many now I lose track, but
even that's hard to believe that the first one came out so long ago and we're already on the second one. Half a billion worldwide.
Wow.
For that, I believe, opening weekend, so yeah.
Unbelievable. Guardians of the Galaxy, for those of you who have not been to the movie theater in the last, 400 years, is basically a band of space misfits and heroes for hire, if you will, as they defend the quote-unquote galaxy, not entirely sure which galaxy it is, but the galaxy, from basically any big bad that comes their way. And in this particular film, they go very deep into character development in a slightly different take from some of the other Marvel ventures. A reminder before we get into the conversation for you at home, of course, that we will be spoiler-filled in this podcast. We want to be able to talk about the film and get into its deeper themes. So if that's the case, we want to be able to have that conversation by addressing the whole thing. But let's just get into it. Arnaldo, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, what do you think?
If anybody's listening and you haven't seen it, it's been over a week. Come on now. Come on now.
There are, I think, four people.
Come on now.
I think there are four people in the United States that haven't seen this movie and 12 people in Canada.
Probably. My wife is definitely one of them. I mean, it to me, exceeded the original. And in the original, we didn't know what to go into. Like, when Guardians came out, it was a huge risk. You know, you have a talking raccoon, a tree that only says three words, like, you know, a guy that came from a show that no one even pictured him as a hero. And then, you know, okay, you have Zoe, you know, she starred in the film, okay, there's your star power. And you're like, hey, Dave Bautista, really? But it worked so well in the first film. It was such a fun and became arguably the best film in the Marvel franchise, Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I think this film surpassed it. It was so much fun. The opening sequence with Baby Groot dancing and while they're fighting a giant monster, like, it was such, visually, it was stunning. Visually, like, you right away you knew the visuals have been kicked up a notch. And then but then you're like, this is still gonna be a fun film. But at the same time, I'm watching it and I'm thinking, okay, I hope there's story behind it also, because I want to be entertained, but I also want a good story. And I think this film did a great job of being fun and being serious all at the right times. Being emotional at the right time. I thought the story was very well told. The story was laid out. And I think, you know, you had a villain that was done right. Ever since Loki, I mean, Marvel villains, they've been a
trope. that about sums it up, actually.
Yeah, that about sums it up. You know, I enjoyed Age of Ultron, but, you know, I admit that Ultron felt kind of flat as compared to his comic and animated counterparts. Because Winter Soldier was probably, you know, the best other villain they had, but he didn't speak much. And I mean, Winter Soldier is probably top three in the Marvel film franchise. I think these two Guardians are one and two now. So that speaks volumes to what this film is. It was such a fun ride. It was such a visually stunning film. I will say, and it's preference, I like the music soundtrack of the first film a little bit better than this one. But there's so much nostalgia in this film, and so much heart, so much laughter, so much joys, so much sadness, that to be able to pack it in a film like a space opera type film like this, kudos to James Gunn and Marvel for doing a great job.
Why do you think it works? Because you talk about it being a fun film and visually spectacular and that sort of thing. I think about a film like Ant-Man. And you know what? I liked Ant-Man. I liked... there are lots of entries in the MCU that I like. There are lots I don't. But, you know, after I came out of Ant-Man, it's very visual film. And I remember halfway through, I actually sort of had this moment where I pulled back and went, wait a second, I'm watching a man surf on ants. And that was sort of an eye-opening moment for me. I just was like, it actually sort of pulled me out of the film, and I had a hard time going back. And I'm not saying it was bad, but it's on my lower end of the spectrum, if you will, maybe middle of the pack of the MCU. What is it about these films that you think sets them apart?
First off, I enjoyed Ant-Man also. It's very underrated. I think Ant-Man, a lot of people liked Ant-Man because we had no real expectations for it. And so it exceeded those low expectations. We didn't actually expect it to be good or borrow it to be good. And it was just a fun film.
Sure.
But I think with Guardians, what stands out is that they don't take themselves seriously, and the audience realizes that and knows that. So you have fun with that because you know this isn't a serious bunch. I think audiences are drawn more to that dysfunction, fun aspect, and they have that from Rocket. And you have so many different personalities within this group that I think each person that's watching it can relate with a certain character. But at the same time, you'd be like, oh, you know, that's my friend so-and-so, and... oh yeah, that's you know, that's Bill, that's Bob, you know, that's Jose, that's, you know, that's Tony. Like, you know, we can sit there and be like, you know, that's what me and my friends were like, you know, growing up. That's what me and my friends are like now. I think that's what makes it stand out. And then going back to visually, I think it does a good job visually because you have bright colors, but it's part of the background still. So it's not distracting, but you notice it and it pops out, you know. And it's just, I feel like the way it's shot, like, you know, going back to that opening sequence, you know, there's a lot of colors, there's a lot of brightness, but the focus was so much on Baby Groot that you see all that visual, but it's not distracting because you're watching Baby Groot dance around. And then when they fall in front of him and different things, it's just like the humor mixed with it. I think that it allows it not to be a distracting, but yet still be visually appealing. And I think that's what sets it apart. And I will say that Marvel gets it right with this. And I think they caught a clue about that Because if we look at the Thor trailer for Thor Ragnarok, it seems like a Guardians of the Galaxy type feel. Even Spider-Man Homecoming, they both seem different than what's been coming out from Marvel lately. And I think, you know, especially with Thor, it's like, you know, hey, it seems like you might get Thor, finally, a Thor film that's appealing to mass audiences of him by himself, because it seems like a fun buddy film that people that really, really enjoy Guardians of the Galaxy, they see the similarities and then they're going to flock to it. So, yeah.
The interesting thing that you say about that, though, is you might get a fun film with Thor by himself, but part of the reason the trailer works is because they brought in the Hulk.
Well, that's what I said. It's a fun buddy film. I expect it to be a buddy film. I don't expect the Hulk to be in for just, you know.
Oh, sure.
Gauntlet beatdown. I expect him to be, and I think he is prominently in the film. So.
Well, I hear it's an intergalactic road movie. That's what I hear it as being referred to.
It's an out of this world character, really, and out of this world in sense of how do you mix the, you know, the Norse mythology that he's in, even in the comics, and how do you make it fresh for audiences with the way they talk, with the way they speak, and you know it works on comic form, so it makes it he's a real difficult character to bring to real life, and I think Chris Hemsworth has done a good job.
Oh yeah, you know,
good job with him. Dark World was such a huge disappointment, and to me, I don't even mind that they were trying to go dark. I just felt like they messed the villain up so much that the darkness just didn't work.
Well, that's not uncommon for the MCU.
yeah, well, and that's what happens. I think the problem isn't even that they can't get the main character right. I think they just haven't been able to get the villains, right. And that's what it comes down to. Fun films that are way better than, I won't say because then people say I'm bashing, but they're fun films that, you know, at least, you know, give us what we're expecting.
Yeah, yeah. I heard that DC Universe throw in there, and I'm still going to accuse you of bashing, but anyway.
it's bad.
But it is true. It's a really different approach. And I think that, you know, you look at a guy like Hemsworth, any problems with the Thor movies hasn't been his fault. And I think the casting has been excellent, especially in terms of their heroes. They've done an excellent job of casting. But it seems like sometimes it just doesn't land the plane. I would even argue that as much as I enjoyed it, Guardians 1 doesn't quite land the plane, to repeat my metaphor. And I like it. I just felt like the film was... Well, okay, it's a film about a talking tree and a talking raccoon, but I mean, it does, the film just feels more disjointed. Like, if you ask me to describe the plot of Volume 1, I couldn't do it. You know, I know that there's an Infinity Stone and they meet everybody, and then at the end they grab the Infinity Stone, and you know, but in terms of a story, I can't tell you. It's all over the place.
No, yeah, I think Volume 1, it was a fun film, and to me it was a simple plot, and that's what made it fun. And the simple plot was, it's just a bunch of individual misfits that come together, you know, and thrown in there is some villain that's not memorable. But you know, his purpose was to bring them together,
right?
And that's what it was. Well, and then this one makes it better, because now we see them actually together, and we see them evolve from just these unknown misfits to friends to family.
The fact that you say that the plot was more simple in the first one because they just got thrown together, I would argue that doesn't mean the plot was simple. It would just mean the concept was. You know, but the plot, I couldn't even describe what was happening because I have no idea. Like, they had a thing and the other guy was trying to get the thing. But really, it was about introducing these characters and getting them together, which is fine. This one, I really liked because It just felt like it was happening for a reason. That was one of the things I like. You talk about them being family, and it is interesting to see how that has grown. And that's a term that we see thrown around a lot now in large ensemble pieces. You know, you certainly see it in the Furious franchise. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and it's kind of they're about as subtle as a sledgehammer with it. But, you know, even in Suicide Squad, towards the end of Suicide Squad, he says, I already lost one family. I'm not losing another one. And which is kind of awkward. It's kind of thrown in at the end of now we're a family. And but this particular Guardians film, it feels like they did it much more naturally.
Yes.
And so, but I was wondering, why do you think that is? Like, what is it about this film that helps the family atmosphere work, and how is it different than other franchises?
I think with this film, like if you go back to, you mentioned Suicide Squad, you know, that one felt force-fed, because nowhere throughout the film do you see them actually feel like they ever came together more than just, we have this job to do. With the Furious franchise, it's always been big about family, but because they all had something in common. You know, they all were about the same thing. It was about the cars. And they had the one guy that brought them together and held them together. You know, because with the Furious franchise, like, even with, you know, you bring in The Rock's character, and, you know, I haven't seen the latest film, so I'd admit that. And yes, I know I'm wrong for that. Or some people say, you know, you're not missing anything. It depends on your preference of the films.
Yeah, of course.
You know, in the previous films, like, you know, he was with them, but he's still not part of the family.
Right.
That's, you know, he's just, you know, the side guy, the friend. But everyone else, they all had something in common. And I think what makes Guardians stand out and feel more natural is that they don't have anything in common outside of the fact that they all are dysfunctional. But you see each individual struggling with what it is that ails them. You know, Peter, he misses his mom, and he wants the father he never had, you know, not realizing that, you know, it was in front of him. Gamora is looking for peace and survival. But then you throw in her sister Nebula, who's looking for, who just wanted a sister. And that, you know, they're fueled by hatred to a father figure who wasn't a father, you know, wasn't even a dad. He was a dictator and an abusive person who made them compete against each other, you know, and they're just always looking to survive.
Yeah.
You have Groot, who's just, I mean, in this film, he's just lovable. He's the kid that's loving on everybody. You know, so he's so innocent that you just, you know, you fall in love with him. You have Drax, who's lost his family. He knows what the love of a family, a wife and kid is. And, you know, was in the first film, he's so lost and fueled by anger. You don't see as much in this film, and you know he still has Thanos in mind, but you see him being able to share his grief, share his happiness, and with Mantis, where she's able to, with her power, just feed off that, and you see, and you're like, you know, there's a man who's literally lost everything. Like, you know, as a father, I'm like, you know, where would I be if I lost my wife and my daughter? And he can reflect on that. He can share that, and then, you know, give back. And he's like that protective big brother in the group. And then you have Rocket, who's just afraid to love. He's afraid to get close, because he's afraid to be abused. He's afraid that he's going to be rejected. So when you see all them and you see them, each one, I think the film does a good job of just peeling the layers of each character, and each person came together, developed on their own, and then they brought all that together as a group. And then you can really see that family aspect, that these aren't just, you know, misfits out for money. They're not just enemies that became friends. They literally have become a family, and they've grown in certain ways that they wouldn't have if they didn't have each other around.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It was also, by the way, listeners, I talked about this film recently on a Real World Theology podcast as well. But one of the comments that came out of that was that in the first film, they became a family, and in this particular film, they learned how to be a family. And I like that description. I would also say things a little differently, because in looking at these other franchises, one of the things I think is, in most cases, it feels like people are running from something, but in this film, it feels like they're running to something. And that's a very different feel. You know, I have seen Fate of the Furious. Obviously, we recorded on it. Mm-hmm. And they start to really explore the idea of family, but it still feels like a bunch of people. It's almost like they're work friends. You know, if The Office had to do with smashing cars, you could argue that the Fate of the Furious franchise is that. But yet it always ends in a barbecue. They're always having a barbecue at the end of the film. It is interesting. I'm glad that you brought up that they have very little in common, because one of the things that we brought up in the Furious film that we noticed is they seem to have even a common set of values in the Furious franchise, and arguably even a common sense of traditional values, like traditionally, almost even a faith. Like they say grace, they have to have Sunday lunch together. They're sitting around with their beer and their hot dog, and it's, you get that feel. It almost feels like it's your family just having lunch. You know what I mean? This does not feel like it. You may be able to relate to characters, but if you can relate to this as a family, you got a problem.
It was like, hey, we're going to pray for your family, because if we can relate to them, you know, early on as a family, then.
But, you know, it's interesting, because in this film, with Volume 2, each of the characters, we get a lot more backstory, which I appreciate. I'm always about character and story over flashbang, boom, and visuals. Like, visuals are great. And I don't even know if I said what I thought of the film at the start of this, but I really think that Guardians has become one of the pillars that they have to build the MCU around, which is so weird to me to say.
They've surpassed the Avengers franchise, I believe.
I wouldn't say that, but I would say that they've set themselves apart from most of the others. You know, I think that there's four main ones now in the MCU, and I think it's Iron Man, Cap, and I think Iron Man and Cap are running their course, and Guardians and Doctor Strange. You know, the rest of them are elements to the story, but I don't feel like they're the pillars for the next generation. Do you know what I mean? For the next phase.
I see that. I honestly wouldn't put Doctor Strange there just yet. I would shoot the gun and say that the next pillars are really Guardians and Spider-Man, with Iron Man and Captain America fading out.
Right.
I think they're going to get Spider-Man that right, that he's the next pillar of carrying the MCU along with Guardians.
The only reason I'm hesitant to agree with you on that has nothing to do with whether or not they're going to get it right. It's just that I know they've only signed for one more film. In his contract, they've got the Avengers films and they've got Homecoming 2. But after that, you know, I don't know where they're going with it. Now, Guardians, they may only have one more film as well, but I see what you're saying. I would agree with that. I just don't know about the length of his involvement.
But, and I would say it's probably that way just because of the way the Sony and Marvel deal is. But the minute Sony sees $1 billion, because Spider-Man Homecoming will cross $1 billion. You heard it here first. Sony's going to be like, whatever you want. Or Disney's going to be like, here's that billion. We're taking him 100%.
But, you know, going back to this family aspect again, you look at these characters and there is some significant stories of abuse you touched on that are going on within these characters. Like, there's a real sense with these Guardians characters. I find there's an innocence, a broken innocence, that you don't get in, say, the Furious franchise. I mean, I guess you get the sense that they're all nice guys. Like, you want to hang out with them. Mm-hmm. But you can't say innocence. Now, you know, but in the Guardians, like, even Groot, by stripping him down to baby Groot in this particular film and giving you that, yes, he's adorable, but there's this sort of, he's so playful, whereas in the first film, that isn't quite there.
That smile he did when he gutted those bad guys and slammed them against the wall, how is that not adorable?
Maybe innocence is the wrong word to use. But there is a sense in each one of these characters that they are almost childlike, and that really comes out in this film. You hear Nebula saying that all she wanted was a sister. You hear Star-Lord saying, all I wanted is my dad to play catch with me, which, for the record, even though I understood it thematically, was my least favorite scene in the film. It didn't get me, but I'm sorry. Where they're making energy balls and tossing it. I'm like,
the fact that was the only thing you think of was a ball.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was funny, but this as a scene, I'm like,
it was also cliche. Like,
yeah, that's like, it.
That in every single film that has that aspect of, I just wanted, I mean, it's everyone uses it ever since Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams.
Yeah, well, it had that feel to it. Now, and I understood what they were going for, and that's fine. Like, it didn't ruin anything for me, but it was kind of funny. In the theater, there was someone behind me who went, aw, he's playing catch with his dad. And I went, okay, let's get back to the film.
Wait, you won't be saying aw in about 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But no, it was amazing to me how many storylines they really explored on the brokenness of the characters. You know, you had and the desire for each one of them to experience love. And that's why I say I think they were running to something. Because in the Furious franchise, for example, going back to that, they're a team together on the job, like you said. But in this one, they're people that are looking desperately for some sort of validation and community.
They're all looking for love.
Yeah.
They're all looking for love.
Yeah, it's everybody's been hurt differently. But it was all from abusive parents. It all comes out in this film, except for Drax. Of course, we see the damage that has been done by losing his family.
You have people that were searching for family and someone who lost family. And I think that's why it was so important that Drax says, you know, we're going after Quill, you know, because we're family.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not because we're friends, you know, we're family. And, you know, Nebula is something that Nebula didn't understand, but I think, you know, somewhat got, you know, afterwards. But, you know, I felt like Drax saying that was, he was the person that needed to say that. Because he was the person that understood what a family actually felt like.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but Dave Bautista was the unspoken MVP of this film. And I couldn't stand him in Guardians 1. I just couldn't stand him. His delivery was weak. I mean, his dialogue was okay. It was fine. I get it. You don't understand irony and figures of speech. But in this one, he was so relaxed. His delivery was on point. He had better dialogue. I was really impressed. And this is the first time I've seen him in a role where I went, Dave Bautista is going to be more than just the big guy. And I don't even mean just in this franchise. Like, maybe whenever Bautista shows up in a film, he's the big guy. In Spectre, I don't think he has a line. So maybe I think this is some growth for him.
Yeah, I think you've definitely seen some growth in him. I think he's becoming a better actor. I'm very interested in seeing him in...
He's in the next Blade Runner.
There we go.
And I was stunned. I was like, Dave Bautista's in Blade Runner? What's happening? What is going on with his life right now? But yeah, I mean, it was really impressive. Yeah, he really was one of the standout characters. Of course, him and Yondu. Yondu, I couldn't stand in the first film either. You're not supposed to really like Yondu in the first film. This film, you're very much supposed to.
You can't help but fall in love with him in this film.
Yes. Yes, you're right.
Michael Rooker. Ah, man. He was, I think, I don't want to say he was amazing. He was great in his role and the aspect of his role. And that scene with him, I won't even go to the scene with him and Quill at the end. Like, to me, the scene that did it for me was him and Rocket.
Hmm. Yeah.
Him and Rocket, that was just, to me, that was probably the best interaction in the whole film between two characters, because the humbling that he got and then the teaching aspect to Rocket to say, you know, we're the same. And Rocket realizing that he doesn't have to be afraid to love, and realizing what Yondu really is, his real character, you know, not character of Yondu, like character deep inside.
Yeah,
you know, to me that was one of the best interactions in the whole film.
Yeah, well, this is what I mean. Like there was a lot deeper psychology. Which I can't believe I'm using that phrase, and I'm going to slap myself later when I realize that I said that. But there's a deeper level of psychology in this particular one entry into the MCU than many of the other ones. And that's one of the things I appreciated. And, you know, you brought up the Baby Groot intro. There was something that I noticed in this particular film, and I think it's a real tribute to James Gunn and his sense of humor. And it seemed like it was almost influenced so much by Monty Python-esque type of... I love awkward humor. I love it. So that's one of the reasons I love this film. Like, people are saying, oh, these scenes, these jokes, they go on forever. That made them funnier for me because they were so painfully awkward that I laughed harder and harder and harder. But, you know, going back to the Baby Groot scene, I think that's a great example of something that James Gunn did the whole movie, and that's not giving you what you want. You know, it's not that he didn't give you what you want on the whole, but there were so many moments that he quote unquote ruined intentionally. And one of, you know, the Baby Groot scene, yes, he's adorable and yeah, he's dancing, but if you don't like that, you're saying, dude, like, get the stupid tree out of the way because I want to see them fight the giant octopus. Like, get out of the way, man. But you get snippets of it. The scene where they've got the button and they're arguing over the tape, which I, even though it was in the trailer, I laughed my head off in that scene. It was so well written. But again, you could be seeing them fighting the aliens, but no, you don't get to. We're not going to let you see that because this unimportant moment is what we're going to give you. And I think there was even one, it happened multiple times in the film, but I'm thinking of another one where Star-Lord and Gamora are dancing and I believe they're about to kiss and something interrupts them. There's a lot of these things. It's like, here we go. No, you're not getting it. But by doing that, there were so many things they pulled back from that when they brought the emotion in, like that scene with Rocket and Yondu, they hit it and it wasn't overkill. Like so many other films go for the overkill. We need all this emotion or we need all this big boom. But Gunn pulls back in such a way that when he gives it to you, it really hits home.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things I really appreciated about this film.
You spoke about the Gamora thing and, their quote unquote unspoken thing.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm probably one of the few people that don't want that to happen.
Really?
I like them not being together, and I hope they never do that.
You're a heartless beast.
Maybe it's more. I'm probably more because I'm like, I don't want her turned into the sex symbol, because she hasn't been that. You know, she's the fierce warrior, the strong, you know, female character, and you know, maybe it's my disgust with comics sometimes where I feel like they go too much in making female characters, degrading them just to be sex symbols when they have opportunities to make them strong. So I like the aspect that he still keeps that, even at the end where you see that, you know, she does have feelings for Peter. She does have that unspoken thing that she doesn't want to, they're not going to explore.
Yeah.
But what's there, and it makes the bond stronger, you know, in a sense, and doesn't complicate things. So, you know, in a sense, I'm like, no, I don't want you guys to get together. I don't want, you know, none of this to happen. But at the same time, I appreciate how the characters have grown close together and seen that, even though, like he said, like some people are waiting for it and he pulls it away. And when he pulls it away, I'm like, yes, pull it away more.
Yeah. I like your reasons, but all I heard was blah, blah, blah. Hashtag Arnaldo hates love. And you can send your emails to Arnaldo at Screenfit. No, no, I understand what you're saying, because so oftentimes you have a strong female character and then all of a sudden, once they're the love interest, they lose that. They become the damsel in distress. I don't think you're going to see that here, because I think that would be...
And that's why I say that, because the Gamora character is such a strong character that I don't want to see her tainted.
Yeah, I understand that. I can see that for sure. Switching gears a little bit, I was wondering what you think of the idea of God in this particular film. And I'm not trying to stretch it. You know, you could stretch the conversation just because, oh, well, we're Screenfish and blah, blah, blah. That's not what I'm saying. This film does seem to address the nature of God through Ego, the Living Planet's character, which, interesting enough, and this was something I didn't realize at the time, but did you know that Ego, the Living Planet, was involved in a swap?
In a swap?
They got the rights to Ego, the Living Planet from Fox. They made a trade with Fox to get the rights for Ego. The apparent, like
a Fantastic Four franchise.
Because it was owned by the Fantastic Four franchise. So what they did is they gave Deadpool the opportunity to switch the powers of Negasonic Teenage Dirtbag, or whatever her name is. And they switched her powers up for Deadpool. So in exchange, Fox said, all right, you can have Ego, the Living Planet.
I did not know that. I knew they made it some type of switch for Deadpool, but I didn't know it was Ego. Look at that.
Yeah. But it's interesting because Ego does refer, well, I think they actually say, so I'm a god, and he goes, small g, Peter. And they talk a little bit about that. So what do you think about the portrayal of this godlike figure?
It's a Screenfish, so obviously I'm gonna bring it like this. Small g Peter was correct. I think in a way it was a perfect representation of other gods compared to God. In a sense of, you know, when I think of different mythologies, and I think whether you see it in other mythologies or even fantasy writing, or just finished The Elite, and I'm on the second one, and they talk about gods and, you know, how the gods appear with us. You know, my wife and I were going through audiobook of Red Queen, and they talk about how the gods now live here, and they, you know, have powers, and they lord over us, and, you know, that's Ego. I think Ego's thing is, you know, he's thinking of himself. And when I think of God, you know, I think of Jesus's sacrifice. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Where Ego is, I love myself. I and I want the world for myself. I want this power all to myself because nothing else can satisfy me. And it's funny because you talk about, you know, everyone in the film was running towards love and Eagle was running away from love. He said he put the tumor in Peter's mom because he knew if he returned to Earth one more time, he would never leave. He was running away from what that fulfillment he was searching for, while the other ones were running towards what will fulfill them. And as you know, as Christians, we know is that the ultimate fulfillment of love is God and you know, his for us. So I think it's a perfect representation of, you know, who the real God is and what lowercase g God represents.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because structurally, the nature of little g God, ego, in this film, it doesn't stray that far away from the Christian faith. For example, the fact that you have a being who can create at will, who incarnated himself in human form, came to the earth, made a son, and wanted to continue that creation. But you're right. There seems to be a stark difference in the motivations and the heart of the character. Now, there are lots of people who would agree that that's what God is. If you just look at the Bible, you could picture God in a way like this. Just if you have no connection to the story, you know what I'm saying? Right. Like, if you don't look at the motivations and the heart behind so much of the scripture, like it's a strange sort of thing. And but this God, you're right, is obsessed with himself. I love the use of the term of the name ego, and I know that's just his name, but it works beautifully here. It works beautifully here. And to go from planet to planet just to continue to glorify himself at the expense of others. Which, you know, God invites us to participate with him. Now, technically, he invites Star-Lord to participate with him, but nobody else. You know, you're either with him or against him in the sense that if you're not able to join him, then get out of the way because his domination and power is just going to consume everything in his path to increase his power. But it's funny because structurally, when you look at it, it's not as different as I thought it would. But it was the tone and the heart behind it that set it apart for me.
The difference is, you know, I see where you're coming from, and I can help you, is that the stark difference is it goes back to that love aspect.
Hmm.
Our God is love, while this God, ego, lowercase g, is the furthest thing from love that there is.
Mm. And yet he comes posing in it. See, here's the thing. Yeah. You know, we talk about fathers in the film. This, you know, the film definitely has daddy issues, as I've heard the phrase used in so many different articles. And yet you have someone here who poses as a father, but really ends up being somebody who's just passed on his DNA, as opposed to someone like Yondu, who has no DNA connection, but seems to have a deeper sense of love for his child.
A child that's not his. And, you know, that aspect kind of reminds me of when you think about a child that grew up without their biological father and are raised by a stepdad, and they reach success, and all of a sudden here comes a biological father knocking on the door, and they're like, who are you?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's when they want something from you is when they show up. And as far as Eagle's concerned, is when he, you know, he wanted something from it. That's when he shows up. Kind of reminds me of Adam Sandler in Waterboy.
Wow, never would have made that connection. In fact, don't even explain it. I just want to think about that for a minute. No kidding. No, go ahead.
Hey, I just thought of it. Near the end when his daddy shows up.
That's right.
He's like, hey, you know, I'm your daddy. Like, you know, do this endorsement deals and, you know, and then the mom comes and takes him out. In this case, you know, Yondu helped in taking out the fake dad and saying, no. Yeah, I'm that kid's daddy.
Well, is it Yondu that says that he may be your father, but he ain't your daddy? Or something along those lines?
Yep, right before, unfortunately, he dies.
Mm. So what goes into being a father then? What is it that makes someone your daddy?
It's being there for them. It's, you know, helping them grow, helping them become a grown-up. In this case, you find out aspects of Yondu and how, you know, he sought redemption for him when he found out, you know, what he was doing by collecting kids and realizing he's killing these kids. And then he picks up Peter and he's like, you know, I didn't save him just because he was small and he could help me thieve. It's just, I needed to save him. You realize who his real character was. And then raising him, he was there for him. He helped taught him. Like, his own ravagers say, you know, you have a soft spot for him. Yeah, because he loved him. And I think that's what it comes down to. I mean, to be, you know, anyone could be a dad, you know, or in this case, anyone can be a father, you know, you can be a sperm donor, but you know, in his case, it's daddy. To be, it's just being there, it's being with them and helping them grow and helping them through all aspects of their life and being involved in their lives. You know, that's what it comes down to. It's not a magic trick. It's just being there.
Have you seen Moonlight?
I have not.
Oh,
it's on my list.
You got to see Moonlight.
Oh, very, very long list.
But Mahershala Ali's character, in some ways, reminds me of Yondu in this film because he's a terrible person, but he ends up being this fatherly voice. And this is my struggle with Yondu. I agree with you. I think being there is the key. But this is my struggle with Yondu, is because he may have been there, but was he? I wouldn't go so far necessarily as to say he is abusive, but let's go back to Guardians here. And, you know, Peter Quill has every reason to hate his guts. There is no tension of family relationship in the film. You know, Yondu is the guy who it was almost viewed as he held him captive. In this film, it sort of changes, but there seems to be a redemption of Yondu in this particular film. But what do you think that looks like?
I think that's what it came down to, is redemption is when you've been humbled. And I think Yondu reached a point of despair and was humbled when, you know, it was all taken away from him. And then that sense of the Ravagers have a mutiny against me. They've killed some of my closest friends. And now the one person that I've never been able to express how I feel as a dad to, because the issues that he explained to Rocket, you know, that they're no different, is that, you know, he didn't feel that Peter would look at him that way, knowing that he was supposed to deliver him to his dad, or when he found out, and things like that. Him reaching that low and then snapping out of it and coming out of it and helping and, you know, instilling that off into Rocket and then doing his ultimate sacrifice, you know, to save Peter. And I think it was said, it was in what he said when he told Peter, you know, in the moment of their most desperate need, is, I don't do that with my head, I do it with my heart.
Hmm.
I think that was the moment of redemption, and we saw it, is that redemption is when you've gotten so low and you've realized that, you know, what you were running away from is what you should run towards to, and the thing we've been talking about, love. And he found that, and I think it was a perfect illustration at the end when all the rest of the Ravagers showed up for Yondu's burial, and you see the fireworks, and, I mean, you can never look at fireworks the same, but the picture I got when I saw the fireworks is, you know, this is what heaven looks like when redemption happens, when, you know, someone becomes born again, or a believer goes to heaven. Like, that's what it is.
It's a beautiful moment, surprisingly touching in so many ways. If Yondu comes back to life because he goes to Tahiti, I'm going to be furious.
He's going to come back to life because they burned him. Little stars.
Well, I don't know. I hear it's a beautiful place. I actually was pretty impressed. Like, the MCU is not known for killing off quality characters. And I thought that was really bold.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that the redemption in this moment, it seems to happen beyond just, hey, he finally did the right thing. And so many movies leave it there. You know, so many films, you know, just regardless of what it is, it's like, oh, he turned around. Look, he sacrificed himself now. He was a bad guy. Yeah. Now he's a good guy because he did that thing. But what really struck me about the funeral was the fact that Star-Lord, Peter Quill, almost reimagines his childhood. You know, he's traumatized by so much of his childhood and search for his father and whatnot. But there's a moment where he's, you know, flashing and thinking about the family and his life. And he actually thinks about himself as a youngster. And Yondu teaching him to shoot a gun, like, it's still not Parent of the Year moment, but he's got this sort of fondness to it. And to me, it was a real picture of grace. And so much of the redemption to me feels like it comes from outside of Yondu. Yondu may have finally, quote unquote, done the right thing, but the grace has been extended to him by the others. And the fact that the Ravagers show up at the end and they celebrate, after they'd been pushing him away and they'd been sort of saying, you know what, this is, you know, you're not one of us and you broke the code and all this stuff. And by the way, side note, man, the one thing that disappointed me about this movie is I wanted to see Stallone and Kurt Russell in a scene together just for the Tango and Cash reunion, but never mind. But I mean, you know, there's sort of this redemption and everybody sort of recognizes they sort of reimagine who he was. And to me, that was really interesting because, you know, as a pastor, I think about that when I think about the nature of grace and how God looks at us and knows what we've done, but almost reimagines who we are because of his grace towards us. And that was a really powerful moment for me. That sort of idea for the redemption coming from Star-Lord, because they could have left it from that and be like, man, he was a good guy. Look what he did. But it goes beyond that for Quill. He actually rethinks his whole upbringing and says, maybe this guy who I've been running from, maybe there was something there. There was some quality, some depth of love that I really didn't notice before. But yeah, no, it was powerful change of character. Really, really well written, I thought.
Oh, yeah, perfectly. And I think definitely that final scene, that aspect, I mean, sums up the film beautifully and how it's just captured all aspects and what made it so great, just that family aspect, the fun, even the dysfunction. But it was all just seeing, you know, running towards love and seeing these characters come together. That's what set it apart.
Yeah. Well, you know what? This is probably a good time for us to start switching gears. Arnaldo, why don't we do Screen It or Skip It?
All right.
Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, Screen It or Skip It?
100% screen it. Screen it now. Screen it 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times. But go ahead and screen it.
Oh, dude. Five times?
Five times if you can.
I wouldn't go that far, but I definitely say screen it. It's a lot of fun. I don't understand the hate. I guess I don't know what people were expecting. It's such a fun character piece. I heard, I think it was James Harleman, who's been on the show, posted online that he can't say that it's better than the first film because it's such a continuation of it. They're so closely tied that it isn't its own thing. And that got me thinking about it because you look at a lot of the sequels they've done. Iron Man 2, in some ways, stands on its own. It shouldn't because it shouldn't exist. But... it's its own thing. Like, you can watch Iron Man 2 without having seen Iron Man 1. But yeah. This film, you know, see the first one and see this one. Understand who these characters are. And it's a lot of fun. Plus, you know, you get baby Groot and, spoiler alert, teenage Groot, which is just fabulous.
And credits. And as I will say this for, since we are at the end, end credits were great and... It was nice to see something different where they didn't tie to other films outside of, you know, you see the collector in, not the collector, the game master in one of the dancing scripts, but the little credit scenes all stood alone for the film.
Yeah, I really appreciated that. I really like the fact that it wasn't just a commercial for the next one, which kind of bugs me every now and then. Doctor Strange... bugged me with that because all of a sudden it was like, oh, here's Thor. And wait a second, he's talking about things we don't know yet. You know, oh, he knows about his dad. Like, what's going on right now? every now and then they do that. And I actually really appreciated that this just felt like its own thing. I know they're going to tie it all together. I'm fine with them tying it all together, but it was nice that they sort of let it be that what it was. And so I agree. But yeah, so definitely. I definitely a screen it for me. And then buy the soundtrack because the soundtrack is a lot of fun.
Definitely, definitely. Like I said, I like the first one better, but the soundtrack was still fun and exciting.
Well, I have to say, I cannot fathom if, you know, the singer-songwriters in the 70s and 80s, when they wrote their music, thought... you know what? This music isn't very good, but I really hope that someday someone writes a superhero movie and it's the thing that most people are talking about. I can't even fathom that. But anyway, Arnaldo, love having you on. Thank you so much for coming back.
Hey, man, I always love being on. And maybe next month we have, what, 2 upcoming? Wonder Woman, Spider-Man?
Well, I have you coming up on Spider-Man, but not on Wonder Woman.
Oh yeah, yes.
We have two good women on for Wonder Woman actually, but
I will gladly yield to that.
For you at home, our next podcast actually is coming up next week. This is a crazy month for me. We are going to have a special youth episode where we talk about the Netflix series controversial show 13 Reasons Why. And
I can't wait to hear that one.
Yeah, I'm really intrigued about how that one's going to turn out. We've got some teenagers. We're going to have them on to share their thoughts on the show and how it has impacted them. So we'll be talking about that next week. As always, you can find us in many of the places you can get podcasts. You can find us on iTunes. Please subscribe to us on iTunes, Podomatic, SoundCloud, Stitcher. And of course, you can find us on the podcast page at screenfish.net. If you go to the podcast page, you can download Fishing for More. Fishing for More is just some small group questions that you can have and discuss after you've seen Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 as well with the people that you see it with, because we think it's really important for you guys to be having the conversation as well. But... as always, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.